In early December, delegates from around the world will sit down to talk climate change at a major UN-sponsored conference in Copenhagen. There will, no doubt, be political wrangling over how to reduce carbon emissions, but away from the politics is the work of climatologists, the people who come up with the models that predict how climate change will unfold. Dennis Wheeler from the University of Sunderland in Britain is one of those climatologists, but he's not only looking at the latest cutting-edge data to map the future of weather. He's reaching back hundreds of years to the logbooks kept by sailors during those early, harrowing naval voyages in the Age of Discovery.
Meteorological journal and sea log of His Majesty's ship, Isabella. Wind direction south, wind force, light airs, temperature 53 degrees, barometric pressure 29.
Dennis Wheeler joins us from the University of Sunderland. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Guy.
Tell me about these logbooks. Where do they come from, and what were they used for?
Well, the vast majority of logbooks we use are the logbooks of ships in the service of the Royal Navy. The Admiralty made it compulsory for all captains, masters and lieutenants, that's to say senior officers on board, to maintain a regular daily logbook of their activities in which they had to describe what was going on board, supplies of food, water taken in, and so on and so forth. But they also were very careful to stipulate that officers had to record the weather.
So they're basically recording temperature and wind speed and barometer pressure and things like that every day?
Well, first of all, from 1680 until about, let's say, 1770, 1780, the first 100 years, we don't have any instruments on board. They were far too valuable and far too complex to put on board something as uncertain as a ship. And for the first 100 years, what we have is useful information on wind force, wind direction, and the general state of the weather. Now, just because it doesn't have numbers doesn't mean it isn't useful for us. In fact, it's extremely useful information. Mm-hmm. But we find that it's very valuably supplemented from about 1780 onwards by the increasing appearance of barometers, that's for measuring air pressure, and thermometers for measuring air and sometimes sea temperatures, which are regularly carried on board by officers of the Royal Navy and by some other ships as well.
And some of these logbooks are from relatively famous journeys, the HMS Beagle, the ship on which Darwin traveled, Captain Cook's boat, the Resolution.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, this particular project that we've just completed is one that is focused specifically on the logbooks of voyages of discovery. You mentioned Darwin already, and he was on board the Beagle for its 3 or 4 year circumnavigation of the globe. And we have Cook as well. These are all skilled scientists, and it's supplemented the normal daily observational routine with much more detailed observations, sometimes taking thermometer readings every hour. And these are amazingly useful for us.
Professor Wheeler, what questions do you hope to answer by looking at this data?
What we need to do is to get a very firm understanding of the degree of natural variation, not only over land, and we understand that fairly clearly now, but we do need to look at the oceans as well. They're so big and they're such an important part of the whole climatic system. And once we've got that clearer picture, what it means is that the people who are engaged in predictions for the future can take their models, the general circulation models, as they're known, the GCMs. These models need to be calibrated, and we can only calibrate them against past conditions. Well, fairly obviously, the more data we have for the past, the more accurate our picture of the past, the better is the calibration on those models. So when we use them to look to the future, we can be just that bit more precise about how temperatures are likely to change over the next 20, 50, or maybe even 100 years.
From these logbooks, are we able to get a sense of how far the polar ice caps have receded and whether there was, you know, more sea ice at the time these journeys were taking place, you know, versus 50 years later or 100 years later or today?
That's right. It's a very good question. The answer is yes, we can. And this is where the non-instrumental data that I mentioned before is so useful, because these ships were careful to record their encounters with icebergs, pack ice and ice that would freeze them up for the winter, because many of them in the Arctic Oceans would be quite prepared to spend a winter up there and engaged usually in a search for the Northwest Passage, the quick route through to the North Pacific Ocean. So we are able to plot very carefully year by year where the ice advanced and how far it retreated. So the summer retreats, the winter advances are dated and they're spatially defined for us. And that's extremely useful data.
Now, the idea is that these logbooks will all be digitized eventually, which will give everybody access to see them. What's it like to handle those old logbooks?
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, some of the older ones that we use from the less famous voyages, we're aware that when we open those pages, it's probably the first time they've been opened in the 200 years since they were written. Mm-hmm. And that's an absolutely extraordinary and very enriching experience.
Dennis Wheeler is a climate researcher at the University of Sunderland in Britain. Dennis Wheeler, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
When you fly, who do you think has been taking care of your airplane? Mechanics in Chicago? San Francisco, perhaps? Actually, there's a good chance that your plane had major repairs recently in another country, like Mexico or China or El Salvador. And the reason that U.S. airlines send about 20% of their planes for maintenance in other countries is simple. It's cheaper. The airlines say foreign mechanics keep planes as safe as any repair shop in America. But investigations by NPR and the federal government raise concerns. NPR's Daniel Zerdling reports.
Do you want to hear where some airlines are sending planes to be fixed? Go to Central America, to the capital of El Salvador. We'll start our visit around the Central Plaza. There are hundreds of market stalls under flimsy awnings, and they give you a quick sense of why more and more American airlines are sending their planes to El Salvador to be fixed. Labor is cheap. A haircut, a dollar. Avocados, two for 25 cents. My interpreter and I stop at a booth where the man's fixing appliances.
What is a typical income here?
I would say between $200 to $250 a month.
Part of you might be wondering, do I want mechanics in El Salvador to fix our planes? And these market stalls provide one possible answer. Mechanics here can fix anything. This guy's taking the motor apart on a kitchen blender. He says a new blender would cost $20, but he's going to fix this one for $10.
You know, if I took a broken blender like that to a repair shop in the United States, they would say, we don't fix that, buy a new one.
Yes, but here, we always find a way to repair it. All of us are poor.
And he's proud that his countrymen are repairing planes now from the States. And here's how it works. U.S. airlines are supposed to overhaul every airplane at least every couple of years. So companies like JetBlue and U.S. Airways and Southwest fly some of their planes down here. And Salvadoran mechanics strip the inside of the plane down to the bare metal. They fix cracks and rust and bad wiring. Then they put everything back together and the plane flies back to the States. Kevin Michaels runs an industry consulting firm called Aero Strategy. He says the record shows these global repair shops are doing a great job.
Over the last 10 years, we've seen a significant growth in globalization. And at the same time, air travel has become significantly safer. If this were compromising safety, I suspect we would have seen it by now.
From NBC News in Washington.
Airline companies back in the States used to fix most of their own planes. They had armies of union mechanics. But that started to change back in 2002. That's when the show was broadcast.
American Airlines cuts flights. U.S. Airways files for bankruptcy. Is United next?
The airlines are trying to survive, partly by slashing the cost of maintenance. Consider, if an airline overhauls its own planes in the U.S., it spends up to $100 per hour for every union mechanic. But the airline spends half as much at an independent, non-union shop, and it spends a third as much in El Salvador. So today, the industry is sending most of its planes to be repaired at private repair shops. Almost 20% of the planes are going to developing countries.
Do you feel just as confident taking a trip with your family on an airplane that was maintained at a place like El Salvador as a plane that was maintained here in the U.S.?
I trust any aircraft that's been maintained to FAA standards.
Peggy Gilligan helps write those standards. She's the number two official at the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. A repair shop can oversee the work on U.S. airplanes only if FAA has given its seal of approval. And then the FAA is supposed to keep inspecting it, whether the shop's in the U.S. or overseas. So far, the FAA has approved about 700 foreign repair companies in countries like Costa Rica, Ethiopia, Indonesia.
The system expects that there are lots of eyes looking at work that's done on aircraft and lots of checks and balances to see that the work is being completed properly.
But actually, the Inspector General at the Transportation Department has investigated those checks and balances, and he warns that FAA inspectors keep missing problems at repair shops, especially in other countries. The Inspector General wouldn't talk with us for this story. He says his reports speak for themselves. So we've asked an NPR producer, Diana Douglas, to read excerpts.
FAA still does not have comprehensive data on how much and where outsourced maintenance is performed.
Translation,
the FAA does not require the airlines to tell them which foreign repair shops they're actually using. So the FAA isn't sure which they should inspect.
There is no standard for all FAA offices regarding initial inspector visits, which can cause safety issues to go unchecked.
Translation: the FAA's inspectors didn't even show up at some foreign repair stations for as long as 3 to 5 years.
Problems existed, such as untrained mechanics, lack of required tools, and unsafe storage of aircraft parts.
No translation needed. The FAA told the inspector general they'd correct these problems. Gilligan says they're working on it.
He has made recommendations that FAA improve its oversight, and we take those recommendations seriously.
But so far, FAA has not put most of the changes in place.
These findings are very, very disturbing.
John Golia used to be a presidential appointee on the National Transportation Safety Board. He says FAA has so little information on foreign repair shops that they don't even know if they're worse or better than shops in the U.S. He worries about them.
We don't know what's going on in those facilities. If we're not monitoring them properly, how do we know it's safe?
Look at flying. It's the safest it's ever been.
The absence of an accident doesn't mean you're safe. You should be monitoring and doing our job before there's an accident, not after.
Back in El Salvador, I called the company that's fixing the planes. It's called Aeroman, and their executives refused to talk to me. So I found some of their mechanics.
What sort of airlines have you worked on?
JetBlue, U.S. Airways, Frontier.
The mechanics at Aeroman told me a troubling story. Early this year, they overhauled a Boeing 737 for U.S. Airways. On January 23rd, the plane was flying with passengers from Omaha to Phoenix. Suddenly, the seal on the main cabin door started failing. Air started shrieking through the cracks. The plane diverted to Denver. U.S. Airways has confirmed this incident. It turns out that mechanics at Aeroman had installed a key part on the door backward. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Tomorrow, more potential safety problems at the repair company in El Salvador. You can view an interactive map showing how aircraft maintenance has extended well beyond U.S. borders at NPR.org.
One small business owner who would welcome Warner's plan is Summer Plum, but only if it's not too complicated. Her one-woman operation in Charlotte, North Carolina, is struggling to stay afloat in part because she can't get the kind of small loan she needs. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, Greg Collard reports.
Summer Plum always planned on being in business for herself. As she puts it,
I work well with others, not for others.
She worked retail for 6 years while having a small business on the side selling her own blend of organic teas.
This is the sweet jasmine, so it's a jasmine tea with lemon balm and raspberry leaf. So
she eventually expanded into massage therapy. Last year, Plum took the plunge. She combined tea with massage therapy and opened Felicity.
It's slow. I mean, it's not fantastic. I can pay the bills, and I can pay them on time, which is an improvement over some months this year.
Plum says a low-interest business loan would have helped launch her business. Problem was, she didn't need much money.
Most of the small loans from the banks are $10,000. That's a lot of money. And I wasn't ready to need that much. I have a small stock. I have a small overhead. There wasn't a need for $10,000. So it was hard to find a loan that was within the realm of what I needed, like $3,000 to $5,000.
She's currently the only employee. Plum says she clears about $600 a month, and she can't afford health care. She'd love to expand someday, but she doesn't trust the banks, not after they wanted her to take on more debt. The paperwork that goes with a Small Business Administration loan intimidates her. But if there's a pool of money dedicated to help people like herself, Plum says she'll give it a try.
Because then I think it would actually make it to the small businesses. When the money went back to the banks, I'm not quite sure where it went. Personally,
her current space isn't much. She rents a small room on the second floor of a men's tailor shop.
It's a little tiny office. I have a desk and a massage table.
But Plum is optimistic. She says she just needs to make it over that first year hump.
There's lots of little jobs that wouldn't get done unless there was one or two-person operations. For society to even, I think, function, you need small businesses like ours.
For NPR News, I'm Greg Collard in Charlotte, North Carolina.
There are schisms within religions over doctrine or social issues. Now there's a split among atheists over religion. The new atheists insist that religion is dangerous and should be treated with contempt, while the old guard says they should work with believers. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
On September 30th, atheists around the world gathered to celebrate Blasphemy Day and the freedom to denigrate and insult religion. Some offered to trade pornography for Bibles, others de-baptized people with hair dryers, and others committed what the New Testament calls the unforgivable sin.
I deny the existence of the Holy Spirit.
I deny the existence of the Holy Spirit, and I am not afraid.
And the Center for Inquiry office in Washington, D.C., opened a blasphemous art exhibit. One painting, called Divine Wine, shows Jesus on the cross with blood flowing from the wound in his side into a wine bottle. Another shows Jesus after the crucifixion with nail polish.
Well, that's Jesus doing his nails, meaning the nail holes in his hand from the crucifixion. And he's made to look kind of effeminate and silly.
Stuart Jordan says he wouldn't have this on his wall, even though he's an atheist. Jordan advises the center on policy issues. He says the controversy over this exhibit goes way beyond Blasphemy Day. It's about the future of the atheist movement and whether to adopt a more aggressive, often belittling approach toward religious believers.
Some are very much for it. And some are opposed to it on the grounds that they feel, look, this is still a largely religious country, and if it's pushed in the wrong way, this is going to insult many of the religious people who should be shown due respect.
Jordan believes the new approach will backfire. Now, he could speak his mind since he's a volunteer, but interviews with others associated with the Washington office were canceled shortly before we arrived. Curious for a group that promotes free speech. Ronald Lindsay, who heads the National Center for Inquiry, claims he didn't know why the interviews were canceled. As for the exhibit and other Blasphemy Day events they promoted,
what we wanted were thoughtful, incisive, concise critiques of religion. We were not trying to insult believers.
But others are perfectly happy to. New atheists like Oxford biologist Richard Dawkins and journalist Christopher Hitchens are selling millions of books and drawing people by the thousands to hear a clear message.
I think it should be religion treated with ridicule and hatred and contempt, and I claim that right.
Hitchens, a columnist for Vanity Fair and author of the book God Is Not Great, is just as blunt in an interview.
We regard this stuff as ridiculous and sinister and dangerous.
Religion is dangerous, he says, because it can prompt people to fly airplanes into buildings and because it promotes ignorance. Hitchens sees no reason to sugarcoat his position.
If I said to a Protestant or a Quaker or a Muslim, hey, well, at least I respect your belief even if I don't agree with it, I would be telling a lie.
And the more outrageous the message, the better, says P.Z. Myers. Myers writes a blog calling for the end of religion. On Blasphemy Day, Myers drove a rusty nail through a consecrated communion wafer and posted a photo on his website.
People got very angry. I don't know why. I mean, it's just a cracker, right?
Myers, who teaches biology at the University of Minnesota at Morris, says he received about 15,000 hate emails. He says the provocative approach works.
Edgy is what young people like. They want to cut through the nonsense right away. They want to get to the point. They want to hear the story fast. They want it to be exciting. They want it to be fun. And I'm sorry, the old school of atheism is really, really boring.
Paul Kurtz epitomizes the old school. He founded the Center for Inquiry 3 decades ago to offer a positive alternative to religion. He's built alliances with religious groups over issues like opposing creationism in the public schools. Kurtz says he was ousted in, quote, a palace coup last year, and he worries the new atheists will set the movement back.
They're anti-religious. They're mean-spirited, unfortunately. And I think that does more damage than good. I consider them atheist fundamentalists.
He hopes this new approach will fizzle.
Merely to critically attack religious beliefs is not sufficient. What are you for? We know what you're against, but what do you want to defend?
The new atheists counter, they believe in reason, science, and freedom from religious myth. And as Ronald Lindsay, who replaced Kurtz, puts it, we'll take the high road or the low road, whatever it takes to reach people with our message. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.